This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, we've heard it all before. Kids these days. Those entitled, narcissistic, superficial, coddled, basement-dwelling millennials. Sound familiar? As part of NHPR's higher education series, A Matter of Degrees, we are transcending the generational stereotypes by posing this question. Do today's students really deserve the label of aimless, risk-averse, and narcissistic? Or are the super-wired, social media-centric digital natives taking steps toward a future that focuses less on the self and more on the mighty big problems facing the world? Here to provide us with a contrary perspective on the millennial generation is David Burstein, author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. He's also founder of Generation 18. That's a nonpartisan young voter engagement organization. He's also a documentary filmmaker. David Burstein, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So you are a millennial, 24 years old, class of 2012. I guess the first question is, do you not drive and live in your parents' basement?
I do not have a car, and I do not live in my parents' basement. So
That was a joke. I mean, but it speaks to this issue of the one size not fitting all, as you write.
Yeah.
The millennials are the largest generation in history, 80 million in the U.S. So why do you think your generation gets so pigeonholed?
Well, you know, I think that we have this tendency in our culture to think about generations really as a way of trying to understand the changes that are happening in our world. And so we do this thing where we lump groups of millions of people together. In this case, it's a group of 80 million people. But it's such a pronounced change. It's such a change that is happening at a particular moment in our history where our whole world is going through a lot of changes. So the things that are happening in this generation, I think, are perhaps more deeply felt, and people are having more direct interactions and experiences as one of the largest groups in the workforce. And I think there's a great tendency right now to confuse youth with this generation. This generation really cares deeply about trying to make a difference in the world. It's a generation of people who are the most diverse, the most educated in history, and it's also a generation that is in the process of, you know, building a day when we're going to make up a third of the electorate in 2020, and we will make up the largest consumer force in the economy in the next couple of years. So people are really trying to understand this generation, but there's some tendencies that people fall back on in terms of ways people have looked at youth in the past.
All right. Well, let's dig into that a little bit. Millennials characterized now as anyone pretty much under 30. A couple of the adjectives used to describe the millennials, they're militant nostalgists. You know, they grow this sort of Civil War era beards and drink old fashions and grasshoppers and mint juleps. Their pop culture is all about flat affect, you know, into mumblecore movies and, you know, all attitude, no plot TV shows. Also overscheduled. Now, you are 24. You already have a really dense resume. Were you overscheduled in high school and in college?
You know, when we think about the word overscheduled, I think the impression is much more of, you know, high school or middle school students who are going to soccer practice and then they're going to these three after school activities. I think that's a different phenomenon, and that's much more parent driven than what's happening with young people who are really choosing to embrace more than one thing. In this particular moment, it's possible to do more than one thing, and then you have to be a multifaceted person in order to succeed in today's economy and today's world. You can't just know, you know, one ability. It's simply not enough for the complex world that we're living in.
Right. I hear you, David, and I hear, you know, when there are no gatekeepers, you are kind of in competition with everybody, so you have to get out there on your own initiative. But unpaid internships, not paying for music and downloads, people's intellectual property not being paid for, is that going to carry the future?
People are thinking about money and the relationship to what people should pay for, I think, very differently than they used to. I mean, you see it just in the fact that the internet, you know, that is part of the frame that this generation has grown up in, and understanding that information should be free. And I think that that concept, it's not actually a devaluing of the information, which I think what people sort of miss. It's being raised in a world where we said that this quality information is part of our right as people, as members of society, to have good quality information for free. And that transcends into how we think about all sorts of things, and also the economic reality. If you know you can get something for free and it's become socially acceptable to get it for free and you're not making a ton of money, it makes it more reasonable for people to go out and do that.
Well, one thing that we know costs a lot of money, education columnist Rebecca Schumann. She's been a guest on this program. She recently wrote an article for Slate, and it was called "The Sad Demise of College Fun." So she wrote there, much of the unstructured free play at college seems to have disappeared in favor of pre-professional anxiety. An entire generation of students seems hesitant or unwilling to veer from the straight and narrow in a collegiate setting. Any truth to that, David? Are college students wary of taking risks or taking liberal art courses that may not even pay off?
I don't think that's true. I mean, in fact, if you look at the freshman survey, which is done out of, I think, UCLA, there's been a sharp decline in, used to be that business was the number one major, and now that's becoming less and less popular, and things like political science and English and things like that are rising again. In fact, there's a sense of realizing that when you are now in your 20s, the life that's ahead of you and the amount you can do, the amount you can accomplish, I think it's actually greater than it has been in the past. The ability to, you know, how much an individual can do in 1 year today versus how much an individual could do in a year 30 years ago, that has changed, that has increased. So I think it gives people a lot more willingness to take risks, because you say, okay, well, I can try this, and if it doesn't work out, I'm going to be on this planet for another 90 years. So what's the worst that could possibly happen? So I think that ability to see into the future and think about the future as being very, very long is really helping millennials actually take those risks, which, again, I think is a good thing.
We're talking to David Burstein. He's author of a book called Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. And this week we've been looking at higher education, and we've been focusing especially on the kind of course offerings and the kind of cultural characteristics of student life. So David is, in a sense, taking up for the millennials. How about the complaints about the helicopter-parented generation? You know, they always had to wear helmets and knee pads as kids, and if they got bad grades, their parents swooped in and intervened with teachers. What does that mean for their human agency, especially politically, something that you are really interested in? Millennials are seen as politically being apathetic.
Well, first of all, millennials are not politically apathetic. In the last two election cycles, millennials voted among the highest numbers that they have in recent history, and in fact voted at parallel patterns to where their parents voted when they were the same age. So that's one thing. But to the second point, you talk about helicopter parents, you know, I think that the effects of that are a mixed bag. For some millennials, I think it has a positive effect. It's allowed them to spend more time sort of incubating, thinking about what it is they want to do. You know, millennials have much closer relationships with their parents than anyone in previous generations. There have been a number of studies that have looked at sort of the amount of contact that children have with their parents today versus 20 years ago. It's an incredible increase. And having a closer relationship with your parents is not necessarily a bad thing, as long as there's that independence. I think now parents and millennials in particular are moving into a role where parents are our mentors, friends, advisors, helping us navigate our life and our world. And individuals have always had people like that in their lives.
And even if they don't live at home, they're a part of that close connection is enabled by
Exactly. Social
media, by using text,
texting, everything.
Right, exactly. So how about using that same technology to shape the classrooms in higher education of the future? And the subject that you're discussing, changing the world. How is that happening?
Well, if you look at, for instance, you know, what happened, I mean, you know, the classic example is what happened in, you know, Egypt around the Arab Spring. So you've got a group of people who come together and say, we are frustrated with our situation. If you actually look at the history of how that started, it was essentially started on a Facebook group and a Google Doc where people put out their frustrations and people gathered together from different parts of Egypt, and they were able to come together around that and then organize and mobilize into offline action. Now, the internet and technology does not create passion. And I think that that's what we really have to remember. The internet is wonderful, technology is wonderful, but it is not a panacea to all of our problems. There are infinite more uses and needs and things we can do with it. I think part of the responsibility of our generation is to keep the internet free, to keep it open, and to continue to build on that and do things like we're seeing now in higher education, like we're seeing, I think we've yet to see the true applications of it in politics and policy. So these are really sort of the big challenges that we're looking at, and I think they're some of the ones that this generation is most uniquely suited to tackle, because we're the generation who understands these platforms and this technology seamlessly. We understand it the best.
David Burstein, representing for the millennials, thank you for providing a ray of hope.
My pleasure. Thanks. So great to be with you.
David Burstein, author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. He's also founder of Generation 18. That's a nonpartisan young voter engagement organization, and a documentary filmmaker. You can find links to more on all of his work at wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth continues to celebrate the spirit of Generation Y with the story of a millennial who is breaking some serious barriers, not in Silicon Valley, but in the field of extreme wheelchair riding. Risk-averse, coddled, helicopter kids? We think not. That story after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we've been breaking down some of the stereotypes about millennials, the under 30 generation so often derided as entitled and coddled and risk averse. Well, Aaron Wheels Fotheringham's story flies in the face of those charges, quite literally. Wheels is a wheelchair motocross athlete. He's used a wheelchair since he was a kid and wouldn't have it any other way. How else would he be able to perform tricks like double back flips that break the laws of physics and gravity, or challenge the notion of just what disability means? Lauren Ober brings us his story.
Aaron Wheels Fotheringham is perched at the top of a 50-foot giganta ramp in the middle of Madison Square Garden. His wheels are pointed down the precipitous slope toward a gap the length of three parallel parked cars, which he intends to jump. The crowd is going nuts. They've never seen anything like this before.
And I just want to know, what are you doing up here, buddy?
Well, when I asked you guys for a wheelchair accessible ramp, this is not what I had in mind.
This mega ramp is about as far away from wheelchair accessible as you can get. But the joke is part of his shtick. This is a guy whose license plate on his souped-up truck reads legless.
Well, since you're up here, you gotta do something. You know the rule, you can't go down the stairs. What do you have in mind?
Well, I was thinking, if you guys get really loud, and you follow me on Instagram, I was gonna do a front flip.
A front flip! Do you want to see a front flip from this guy today? All right!
Now, anyone doing a front flip off of anything is pretty impressive, but it's all the more spectacular when the person doing the trick is buckled into a neon green wheelchair. The 22-year-old Wheels has spina bifida and has used a wheelchair since he was in grade school.
I'm not paralyzed at all. I have spina bifida, and it affects my back and blah, 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 all that boring stuff I've never really read.
He's also an adrenaline junkie and an action sports nut. If it involves big tires, big air, or big consequences, Wheels is into it.
I love adrenaline, you know, even before skate parks. Like, I'd definitely knock on people's doors and roll away as quick as I could with my friends.
Wheels does what he calls WCMX, or wheelchair motocross. It's like BMX, except with four wheels instead of two. Oh, and a disability thrown in just to keep it interesting. Wheels practically invented the sport. There are other wheelchair users out there doing WCMX, but Wheels is the undisputed king. He's gone bigger and jumped farther than anyone. You ever see an average guy in a wheelchair do a double backflip? No? That's because only Wheels can do that. Wheels got his start in action sports in Las Vegas after a trip to a local skate park with his older brother. He was 8 at the time.
I'm sure I'm not the first one to ever drop into a skate park on a wheelchair, but I didn't see anyone before me. I just looked up to BMXers and, you know, X Games, and I was like, well, I could do that. And then my brother helped me, you know, get to skate park on my wheelchair and pretty much pushed me into a bowl. And, I mean, from then on, I was hooked on it, and it, you know, it was a fun challenge, and, you know, I just fell in love with the sport.
Sorry, when your brother pushed you into a bowl, I mean, did you fall? Like, the angle of that is not meant for somebody sitting, right?
No, like, I mean, in fact, the first couple times I went down, I face planted and, you know, hurt my wrists. But, you know, he kept helping me back up, and then, like, after a couple tries, I mean, I rolled away from it.
And before Wheels even hit puberty, he was a fixture at his local skate park on his wheelchair. Wheels uses the term on a wheelchair rather than in a wheelchair. It might sound like semantics, but for a guy who doesn't feel confined by his chair, but rather liberated by it, the words make a difference. Soon the skate park became too easy. Wheels needed a bigger challenge.
After a while of putting in hours, you start progressing and doing bigger tricks and bigger drop-ins, and then I did a 360. Then that got boring. Then I wanted to do a backflip. And kids at the skate park were saying, you should learn a backflip on a wheelchair. I think they were just messing with me, but I took it serious.
So Wheels went to an action sports camp and practiced flipping into a foam pit.
And in 2 days of going to that camp, I landed the first wheelchair backflip in history. And then I was just like, whoa, this is fun.
That all leads us to now, with Wheels touring the world with Nitro Circus Live, a sort of extreme variety show for action sports led by motocross legend Travis Pastrana. Wheels is an integral part of the spectacle, which also features some of the world's best skateboarders, BMX riders, and daredevils of all kinds. Think people jumping monster ramps in igloo coolers and Barbie cars. Of all of the athletes hucking themselves off of tall things, and hucking is the term the kids use, none gets as much applause as Wheels.
Now, folks, Wheels has just casually said, do you want to see a front flip? And I've been telling you how tough this guy is and what an inspiration this guy is.
Then the announcer tells the crowd how Wheels knocked himself unconscious trying this trick before.
He used to do it off a 30-foot gap. But now that he's here in New York City, he wants to do it for you guys for the very first time over a much bigger 50-foot gap.
Oh, mercy.
So, New York! Do you want to see a kid on a wheelchair throw a front flip?
Oh, my goodness!
And with that, Wheels descends down the 5-story ramp. Fireworks spray out of his specially designed wheelchair as he picks up speed. He hits the lip of the ramp and tucks his head. And by some miracle of physics, his wheelchair, named Rolanda, follows. He flies over the gap and lands with a bounce, wheels down on the other side. A giant airbag catches him before he hits the arena wall. The crowd loses it. It's equal parts breathtaking and unnerving watching Wheels soar so high above the ground. Wheelchairs are most definitely not supposed to do this. But don't try to tell Wheels that.
Wheelchairs got a misconception or something, because I feel like people are always trying to put a limit or a stereotype along with it. And that's what I'm trying to break. That, yeah, I'm on a wheelchair, but I can go down a 50-foot ramp.
And that story was produced by Lauren Ober for WBUR's Only a Game. You can find videos of Aaron Wheels Fotheringham in action on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. As part of NHPR's series A Matter of Degrees, we asked you to think back on your school days and tell us what was on your college playlist. Here's a little sample of what you were jamming to back in the day.
Buffalo soldier, dreadlock rasta, it was a buffalo.
Sheep. What's up, black sheep? No, not who I am or when I'm coming, so you sleep. Wasn't in my room, I wasn't in your sphere. Knew not who I was, but listen here.
Take a load off Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off Fanny.
And you put the load. I drink a goose for breakfast, an insure for dessert. Somebody order pancakes, I just sip the scissor. That right there could drive a sane man berserk. Not to worry, Mr. Ace to the Izzles, back to Wizard.
Thanks to everybody who shared their songs. Really brings me back. If you'd like to make an addition to the playlist, just visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth. Stay with us. Word of Mouth continues with author George Saunders. Last year, he addressed graduates at Syracuse University and shared his advice for a successful future. Be kind. We'll experience some kindness after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As part of NHPR's A Matter of Degrees series on higher ed, we heard some advice to high school graduates from David McCullough Jr.
None of you is special. You're not exceptional.
My guest, the writer, journalist, and college professor George Saunders, also made a short speech at a graduation ceremony that quickly went viral. He was speaking to the class of 2013 at Syracuse University, where he teaches. Seems to be a new phenomenon in commencement addresses. They've become sort of like TED Talks, passed around and commented upon. They become comics, and in the case of George Saunders, a short film.
What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was there in front of me, suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly. Or to look at it from the other end of the telescope, who in your life do you remember most fondly, with the most undeniable feelings of warmth? Those who were kindest to you, I bet. But kindness, it turns out, is hard. It starts out all rainbows and puppy dogs and expands to include, well, everything.
That's from an animated film adapted from George Saunders' graduation speech, which is now also a book called Congratulations, by the way, subtitled Some Thoughts on Kindness. And George Saunders, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about one of those regrets that you mentioned in your speech, the girl from the seventh grade?
Sure. Well, you know what I found is when you're doing this kind of speech, you want to pick the least egregious regret that you have. You know, so this one was a girl in middle school, basically, who came to our town. And she wasn't exactly bullied, but she was sort of teased a little bit and kind of, you know, she was kind of this embodiment of what we'd read about in our religious classes, a person who is in need, and but at the same time, one, not having exactly the courage to do it, you know, that feeling that if you go to save a drowning person, you might get pulled under, which in middle school is especially acute. So, I mean, I suppose like most people, I just kind of turned the other way, basically, and then she left town, you know. So this speech that I gave at Syracuse, originally I gave it in 2004 at our daughter's middle school graduation. So in that case, it was sort of like a link to the middle school years, you know. But that, among many other kind of failures of kindness, still kind of resonate with me. And as I'm getting older, they seem to kind of loom larger.
The softer advice in your message was to for graduates to try and be kinder. Kids going into the world, you know, panic and fear about finding a job, paying back massive loans in many cases, or fulfilling parental expectations when they paid for tuition. You know, the perception is that there's very little room for considering kindness.
I would say flip it around the other way. Now I had a small dose of this when I was when I went to Asia and worked in the oil business. Well, I got sick, quit that job, came home, and at that time the oil market went into this bust cycle where there were no jobs, and I kind of messed around until my degree was sort of not really valid anymore. At the, you know, a couple years later, but at the same time, a lot of kids that I'd gone to school with who had gotten really wonderful engineering jobs, and their whole focus was to be successful and to get the best job, you know. Well, in that bust cycle, suddenly they were out doing whatever, you know. So to me, it seems like I totally sympathize with this generation. And when we have daughters who are in their 20s, and you can just feel the way that they've been kind of, in a way, set up. Because on one hand, as kids, they were told that anything was possible. And then the financial thing happened, and we're like, oh, actually, almost nothing is possible. Hmm. And that's a really cruel double whammy. But I would say in the long view, you know, in the long view, to get your and it's hard to say this because you feel like you're preaching, and I don't mean to sound that way, but to get one's spiritual house in order is going to be sound thinking no matter what weather you find yourself in. I mean, God knows you could get yourself in a position of such wonderful, godlike prosperity that you could turn into a horrible person if your focus wasn't in the right place. Mm. And certainly, you know, I've been in that situation of not working and trying to sort of scrambling around the basement of American capitalism, trying to make things work out. That can be a soul killer too. Mm. So I think what I was trying to say in my allotted 8 minutes was, regardless of the weather at the moment, healthy spiritual interest is an incredible coat for any kind of situation you get into. You know? And it was 8 minutes, so it was sort of a tough, that's a tough gig, you know.
We're talking with the writer George Saunders about his new book based on a 2013 commencement address to graduates at Syracuse University. It is called Congratulations, by the way, Some Thoughts on Kindness. Well, I'm not sure that I could hear, as a graduate from college, your message in the same way that I can appreciate its wisdom today. And who is it for? Is it the graduates or the big audience on YouTube?
Honestly, it was kind of a, it was the last thing I had to do last spring before I got to go back to writing. So, and I'd been asked by my dean to do it. So I just, okay, I'll do it. And then didn't really know that it would get out into the world. I mean, I guess you always sort of hope it will, but I didn't, you know, and the day I gave it, it wasn't really any big deal. It was just sort of, yeah, good. Okay, now go have your summer. So, but I think probably, yeah, I mean, I don't even remember who gave the speech when I was in college, you know.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that. Some admiral gave the speech when I was in college. I don't remember much of what he said. And I actually read something when I was looking up something about graduation speeches. Gary Trudeau, you know, the Doonesbury comic guy,
yeah.
Gary Trudeau. So he gave an address in the middle of the 80s and said, the chief function of the graduation speaker has always been to prevent graduating seniors from being released into the real world before they've been properly sedated.
I think that's totally true. And, you know, when you're given this was actually a convocation speech for the College of Arts and Science. So the big speech was the next day by I don't know who it was. But, you know, when you're doing a speech like that, you are taking into consideration the two-thirds of the audience that is parents and grandparents mm-hmm. and squalling infants, you know. So
yeah, there was a squalling infant in the film that I remember of your speech, actually.
Yeah, there was also, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty tough gig, you know, but for a story writer, it's great because it means you don't have time to prove anything. You know, you don't really even have time to give examples. You're sort of just exhorting in a certain way. And I guess my thought was, you know, if there's some kid out there who has already had those thoughts, then that's a sort of an endorsement. Which, you know, in teaching writing, that's really the way it always works anyway, is the student has already come to a realization 85%.
Mm-hmm.
And just to hear the voice of quote-unquote authority say, you know, suddenly then it goes to 99% and they can execute it. So I don't have any illusions about it, you know, sort of having that big of an effect. But, you know, I guess, it was just nice. It was nice. Sometimes it's nice to say the things that you really believe mm-hmm. and to get out onto the sort of limit of sort of corniness. You
yeah.
know, like I'm used to writing proper essays where you have to prove it. Mm-hmm. And here there wasn't really time, you know. And there are so many wonderful books that prove it. I mean, the David Foster Wallace speech, This is Water, is a really wonderful yeah. kind of 25-minute, in his typically, you know, brilliant way, a brilliant piece of rhetoric demonstrating this idea or a similar idea about one's mind, where one's mind should be in the world and so on. So, it's been funny to see that this thing had keeps having a life after that afternoon.
Right. People all over the world have watched it, talked about it, passed it on. It was made into the short film that we played a clip of. And now this book. But what was it like for you, George Saunders? I mean, do you feel like you have diminished in any way some of that regret that's been knocking around since seventh grade when you wanted to be
nicer?
No, I
mean, well, what has happened is I think I've given it a lot more thought. In other words, like this notion of what is kindness in the first place, and which I don't take up in the speech, but kind of like, well, okay, so if my goal was to become a kinder person, first of all, I have to define what that means. that turns out to be a fairly big fish, you know, to say, well, kindness is not just being sweet. It's not just being acquiescent, not just being nice. Maybe it has to do with being helpful to people around you. That's a good one. But then when you start thinking about that, even that can get to be a pretty deep well. So I found it more frustrating as I get older that I am not in full control of my self, you know, that I can get irritable or that I can, a day can go by in which I wasn't actually really there, you know, that kind of thing. And it's almost like, you know, when you're carrying a pile of papers and one of them falls off and you bend to get it and another one falls off and then four, you know, pretty soon the whole pile of papers is on the ground blowing across the yard. It feels that way to me that at this point, being so convinced that this is the main thing we should be thinking about, it kind of peeves me that I can't get better at it. And I think at 55, I've just realized that this problem, which is actually about kind of getting the ego in check, is really a huge, intractable, lifelong problem. And I started late, you know. So it's a little like you said, oh, I'll just roll this boulder off this mountain. I'll get started, you know, when I'm 55. And you realize it's actually the primary problem, and it's really stubborn.
I hope the graduates can hear it.
But they're also nice anyway. You know, before I gave the speech, right before I was going to launch in on this tirade about kindness, a girl passed out in the crowd.
Oh.
And it was amazing to see every kid around her just leapt in and helped, you know, grabbed her, held up her head. Some of them were very smart to get out of the way so the paramedics could get in. And I thought, oh, my God, maybe I don't have to give this speech after all. I mean, this is a pretty natural human tendency. So I'm getting out of the kindness business after this one. Going back to my armed robbery group.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
George Saunders MacArthur Fellow, winner of the Penn Malamud Award and the Story Prize. His new book is called Congratulations, by the way, Some Thoughts on Kindness. It's a slim little volume with a big message. You can find more on the book and a link to watch the short film and the speech it was based on at wordofmouthradio.org. In another noteworthy commencement address from a man of letters, back in 2005, the writer David Foster Wallace delivered the commencement address at Kenyon College. 3 years later, the acclaimed novelist had committed suicide. But his speech lives on and has become a sort of the places you'll go of the digital age, shared on social media and republished in print around graduation time. Here is just an excerpt of that enduring speech.
Please don't worry that I'm getting ready to lecture you about compassion or other directedness or all the so-called virtues. This is not a matter of virtue. It's a matter of my choosing to do the work of somehow altering or getting free of my natural hardwired default setting, which is to be deeply and literally self-centered, and to see and interpret everything through this lens of self. People who can adjust their natural default setting this way are often described as being well-adjusted, which I suggest to you is not an accidental term. Given the triumphant academic setting here, an obvious question is how much of this work of adjusting our default setting involves actual knowledge or intellect. This question gets very tricky. Probably the most dangerous thing about an academic education, at least in my own case, is that it enables my tendency to over-intellectualize stuff, to get lost in abstract arguments inside my head instead of simply paying attention to what's going on right in front of me, paying attention to what is going on inside me. As I'm sure you guys know by now, it is extremely difficult to stay alert and attentive instead of getting hypnotized by the constant monologue inside your own head. May be happening right now. 20 years after my own graduation, I have come gradually to understand that the liberal arts cliche about teaching you how to think is actually shorthand for a much deeper, more serious idea. Learning how to think really means learning how to exercise some control over how and what you think. It means being conscious and aware enough to choose what you pay attention to and to choose how you construct meaning from experience. Because if you cannot exercise this kind of choice in adult life, you will be totally hosed. Think of the old cliche about, quote, the mind being an excellent servant but a terrible master. This, like many cliches, so lame and unexciting on the surface, actually expresses a great and terrible truth. It is not the least bit coincidental that adults who commit suicide with firearms almost always shoot themselves in the head. They shoot the terrible master. And the truth is that most of these suicides are actually dead long before they pull the trigger. And I submit that this is what the real, no bullshit value of your liberal arts education is supposed to be about. How to keep from going through your comfortable, prosperous, respectable adult life dead, unconscious, a slave to your head and to your natural default setting of being uniquely, completely, imperially alone, day in and day out.
The writer David Foster Wallace addressing the graduating class of Kenyon College back in 2005. You'll find a video of his entire speech on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And stay with us for more Word of Mouth in the Speech of the Future, a look into just how far speech recognition software has come after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We all remember when Siri first came out, those videos of the iPhone's talking electronic assistant laughing, telling jokes, answering silly questions. They were all over. She later advanced to beatboxing and rap.
Dead right if they head right. Siri there every night. Pop have been smooth since days of underoos. Never lose, never choose to. Cruise who do something to us.
Willa Remus is senior technology writer for Slate. Given predictions that wearable computers which respond to speech commands will be the next big digital thing, Will wanted to test how far speech recognition software has come. He dictated an article to Siri for Slate called, funnily enough, I didn't type this article. Willa Remus, nice to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me.
So you didn't type this article. Your iPhone did. How?
That's right. So I used the Notes app on my iPhone. There's a little microphone button in the bottom left. You press that and you can talk to your phone and it will try to figure out what you said and type it for you.
So what was your goal in trying this exercise?
Well, Siri, which is Apple's voice assistant, has been out for close to 4 years now. And when it first came out, there was a lot of hype around the idea that you could just talk to your phone and it would answer your questions or do things for you. Then I think people got a little disillusioned because it turned out Siri would often misunderstand what you were saying. And so that sort of impeded the usefulness of it as a tool. It became more of like a parlor trick. You know, you could ask Siri a funny question and it would give you a canned joke response. But Siri's been out for a long time now, and quietly, behind the scenes, Apple has been working really hard at improving it in several respects, one of which is the speech recognition technology that enables it to understand what you're saying. So I wanted to see how far it has come.
So were you watching for typos as you were walking along and talking to Siri?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, it would never have occurred to me to try this, except that I was recently talking with some folks at Google who were telling me how much their voice recognition technology had improved. Sorry, it's speech recognition technology. Voice recognition means recognizing who's talking.
Uh-huh.
Speech recognition is recognizing what you're saying. So Google had told me how much their technology had improved, and I tried it out, and it worked great. And then I thought, well, why don't I try it with Apple as well? And so I composed an email to my editor suggesting that I dictate a story. It came out so well that I was really, really taken aback. And so I decided to go ahead and try to do the whole story just by talking to my phone.
Don't we all have just endless fun talking about the kind of mistakes Siri makes? So what were some of those that came up for you?
Yeah, so it wasn't perfect, but it did surprisingly well overall. Where it ran into trouble was mostly with uncommon words. I think a lot of times the speech recognition technology looks for the most common word that you might have been saying. So, for instance, when I said the word homonyms, I was actually trying to say Siri still has a little trouble with homonyms, and it came out how men's. I also was talking about Siri's frequent misunderstandings, and I got the word series, S-E-R-I-E-S, frequent misunderstandings.
That was one of the funniest ones I noted. I mean, Siri must be used to hearing the word series.
Yeah, you know, it does fine with the word Siri. It capitalizes it properly and everything. But I guess when you put the possessive on it, it mistakes it for the word series because that's a more common word. So I ended up having to say the frequent misunderstandings of Siri in order to get that across correctly.
Well, you mentioned, Will, that Siri is now a few years old, gotten much better. But tell me more about Google's technology advancing rapidly. What's going on there, and what do you think is the motivation there, beating out Apple?
You know, it's not just about beating out Apple, although that's certainly always part of it. I think Google has several different motivations for improving its speech recognition technology. But one of the big ones is the fact that it's now, this year, planning to come out with Google Glass, you know, the smart glasses that you
and wear on
Google
your head.
Glass. Exactly. And you can't control Google Glass with a touchscreen keypad, obviously, because it's on your face. All you can do is talk to it. And as a result, Google has had to work really hard on making sure it understands what you say when you talk to it. And I think that has spilled over into the quality of its speech recognition tools on Android mobile phones as well, and on the Google app on your iPhone.
Apple, of course, not to be outdone, has been buying up a lot of speech recognition software companies. How is it doing within this competition?
It's hard to say objectively. I think both have their pros and cons. In my experience, Google's technology is really good at what's called voice search. So when you're doing an internet search, you want to ask a question about the world. Google does a wonderful job of understanding that. And that's partly because Google's computers, Google's software is just so good at search in general. It looks not only at the sounds that you're making, but it also tries to infer your meaning and maybe work backward from there to what the words might have been. So for instance, I was telling Google the other day, set a reminder for me to email Ben at 4 o'clock. Now, it started typing Bennett instead of Ben at, but when it heard me say 4 o'clock, it realized I must have said Ben at, not Bennett, and it changed.
Wow, that is so interesting to think of, but I'm also thinking about the long term of this trend. If we're going to be generating more text, that's something that takes up more space. It is more searchable, less private. I mean, is there any concern at all about using speech recognition software rather than just having a conversation?
Well, that's interesting. You're talking about the possibility that speech recognition software built into someone's device could pick up maybe words that people are saying in their everyday conversations.
I'm wondering about that.
You know, I haven't heard much about that. It's certainly a possibility. I mean, more and more of what companies like Google do these days is try to take interactions and events that happen offline and convert them into data that can be stored online and that can power Google's understanding of the big wide world beyond the internet. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's something they look into in the future. I think for now, the main goal is just to make it easier to interact with your devices, especially as we move from smartphones where you can type to wearables like Google Glass and also like smart watches. You know, Apple has the rumored iWatch coming out. They want to make sure that you can interact easily and don't have to be fiddling with tiny, tiny buttons.
Hmm. I was imagining you, when reading this, walking down Hudson Street, talking into your telephone and thinking, wow, that'd be really weird, you know, to be sort of talking a memo in. But I suppose it just appears to anybody else like you're just talking on the telephone. Did it feel weird at all for you to be talking an article?
It did. You know, I felt a little bit, as I mentioned in the article, I felt a little bit like Joaquin Phoenix's character in the movie Her, you know, walking around muttering sweet nothings into my phone, oblivious to the world around me. I did feel a little silly. That said, I think there are a lot of circumstances, especially when you're on the go, when it's less awkward than having to, you know, have the phone right up in front of your face, hunting and pecking the little keys as you're trying to type a text message. It's a lot easier to just hold down that home button on your iPhone, wait for Siri to pop up and say, you know, send a text message to Virginia.
At the same time, would you trust using speech recognition to send a text message or an email to your boss's boss?
No, I wouldn't. Although, you know, of course, as with typing, you can go back and edit. You know, you can dictate and then see how it interpreted what you just said and then go back and change it if you need to. So if it were a long email, maybe I would dictate it, but then I would use the keys to make sure I got all the punctuation right and everything.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Will Oremus is senior technology writer for Slate, and you can take a look at his article, Flubs and All, that he mostly wrote using speech recognition software on his iPhone. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We invite you to join Word of Mouth's mission to spread new ideas. You can post links to segments on your Facebook page. You can retweet things you heard to your followers or email segments to your friends. Just click on the Facebook, Twitter, or email icons at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth on Saturday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.